Welcome to Sartastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. This podcast is dedicated to Fraser Mendonca, who left Denver and Leti in September 2023 before their October road trip to Northern BC and the Yukon.
Scene 4. January 2024. Somewhere in eastern Finland. Professor Scamander, before we start the first chapter of the textbook, I wanted to get something out of the way. I don't quite understand why you were meddling with my research on Archimedes' ancestrals. After a trip back in time to Swatzi, I kind of understand why Archimedes, but why Thestrals? Has your interference got to do something with the Deathly Hallows at Old Crow?
What gave it away, Aranya?
Your letters, actually, to Ogilvy and Professor Wanderson. And I'm still curious about how Ouroboros, your pet alchemy, got into the Muggle brain.
Well, I need to find Timothy first to answer that question. I've not had the tracking spell left open this long. Niflo's unnatural at this, so I'm guessing the clue Dougal found is misdirection. But let me tell you about the letters that you found. You see, Professor Tahatiavine summoned me to Corkea Thorni on December 7th, 1941, the night of the attack. I did not know Professor Wanderson, who was an interesting young man trying to understand the oracular tradition and learning so many languages. Like, he knew French, German, Hebrew, Sanskrit, Greek, Latin, and who knows what else. I always doubted that he might also be a parcel tongue, and perhaps for all these reasons he was sought after by the Ministry of Magic. It's a rare skill set, and also there's this uncanny demeanor, because he had bravery in spades, but he was so humble. Something Mary Mears could definitely learn.
But you always thought that there were no strange creatures, there were only blinkered people. How come you speak so highly and so well about people with so much admiration in these letters? It's shocking to me, actually, now that I see this other side of you.
I softened a bit after I met, you know, my salamander. And also after this 1941 conversation at Corkea Thorni with Professor Tahatiavine. She shared the letters that she had exchanged with Ogilvy over the years about, yes, you're right, the Deathly Hallows. 100 points to Mary Pelle. Professor Wanderson and I were required to go on a mission at the time to relocate the Deathly Hallows again from near Mount Schaefer in Old Crow. The Muggles would soon be building the Alaska Highway. Although it wasn't anywhere near Old Crow, Professor Tahatiavine didn't want a third relocation in Western Canada, especially with so many changes. Like, we had the advancements in radar technology proliferating in the 1930s, and then the attention around oil seeps from the bluffs overlooking the Mackenzie. So she was worried that they might start paying attention to the oil seeps from the bluffs overlooking the Porcupine River around Old Crow, and that could be a little risky for us when we consider the Deathly Hallows. She was grateful to Ogilvy for helping her locate these unexplored sites in Western Canada, but it was time to find another site, and that meeting in 1941 was what kind of softened my tone even more. And that's why you see that I speak highly and with so much admiration. And especially if you had to personally meet Professor Tahatiavine and even Ogilvy for that matter, they were made of something else.
Okay, I need to stop you here again, Professor Scamander. My research was near Bluefish River. It was near the Rampart House and even some odd trails surrounding the Porcupine, Caribou and Wolves in that area. I wasn't even planning to go north or east. If anything, I was heading south to Partridge Creek to collect some samples of discontinuous permafrost and verify the thestral wings found at a site by my colleague.
Well, I know your research was years later, Aranya, but you were quite close. And given the times, Professor Tahatiavine didn't want to take the risk. She and Ogilvy had already relocated the Deathly Hallows in 1896 from northern Alberta, soon after the Chief Healer's birth. And I cannot reveal the exact location, but I can give you a hint. You might want to investigate the geological history of the Peace River embayment. And from our little trip back in time to 1965, you probably got one part of the puzzle.
The one about the chief healer's birth every 500 years when the Surunyoki floods?
I believe that was a conversation you had with Professor Abbott.
Oh yes, I remember that clearly. I mean, that definitely helps me understand one piece, but there are lots of questions.
I'm sure there are, and it will be revealed in time. I am sorry, it seems a lot mysterious, but it isn't. Let's go back to this. The chief healer's birth, right, every 500 years. It was Copernicus who actually discovered the couplet and made that birth prediction. He met Paracelsus during the epidemic of 1519, as both were physicians and held quite controversial views about the canon of that time. They became rather good friends. So they collaborated and they encrypted the prediction such that you needed expertise in astronomy and alchemy. And it was unconventional expertise. You couldn't get it by practice. You kind of had to be a child prodigy. But you needed that level of expertise in astronomy and alchemy to crack that code again. So it was useless in the hands of any other person. One more thing that might help this mystery is that Paracelsus was a regular customer at the Leaky Cauldron due to his somewhat magical predilections. You must have heard the rumor about the Philosopher's Stone, and he believed in it. And there were some other things that he was doing while he refuted the canon of that time. So there were these things which made him a fierce friend of the owner of the Leaky Cauldron at that time. He thought, and he convinced Copernicus, that it's best to leave it far away from Muggle eyes with the owner of the Leaky Cauldron, but he did not know that witchcraft would soon become a crime. And in 1542, it did become a crime, and it continued to stay so for almost 200 years until the act was repealed in 1736. So that's a long, long time. So that was a lot of population fleeing because they feared the persecution at the time. And also, the owner of the Leaky Cauldron died in 1555 during the Bloody Mary persecution. But the owner gave Copernicus's notes to a trusted friend who kept it safe for generations until the bravest and the most trustworthy Gryffindor, Professor Dumbledore, helped them see the inherent risks and brought the notes to its rightful place. Hogwarts. It's the safest place.
Yeah, I guess you do have the Forbidden Forest and you can keep it there forever. So that was definitely a good place, and it was good that he managed to convince that family.
It's odd to me every time I meet Professor Wanderson, or at least when I used to meet him, because he passed away in 2013. We are now in 2024, so it's been quite a while. It always made me feel strange, because I always got that same sense of assurance when Professor Wanderson was around. I also was not surprised when I was told that he was the founder of Mary Mears. But I digress. Aranya, I'm sorry. I've been rambling for quite some time now. I am sure you have questions.
Professor Scamander, I think Professor Dahati Yavine cracked the code, didn't she? Because I can't believe that anyone else could. I guess you would know the answer. I would probably assume that Professor Dahati Yavine is the one who cracked the code. And how does Ogilvy come to the scene? What's his role in our scheme of things? And very strangely, I find that our founders are born after our school's founding year of 1917. For example, Professor Wanderson was born in New Zealand in 1922. Are these just ceremonial?
No, not at all. And yes, Professor Dahati Yavine did crack the code, but with some help from Cassandra Trelawney. And actually, she is the reason we have founders who were born after the founding year of the Fraiston School. When I was asked to be the headmaster, we had only William Long, the founder of your house, Mary Pelle. I was a bit confused at that time because I was under the impression that Professor Dahati Yavine, William Long, and William Ogilvy were the founders, and that they had only three houses, unlike Hogwarts. I even asked them if they deliberately left out the Slytherin house at the Fraiston School. There was no Voldemort precedent at the time. He wasn't even born. But I still tried, and I asked them, I said, we know in hindsight that Voldemort came, but there was no precedent to know that the Slytherin house could be left out. Professor Dahati Yavine explained that Cassandra had a vision of the founders of the school, and only those four founders embodied the ideals of Mary Pelle, Mary Mears, Mary Metzo, and Mary Kotka. In her vision, only William Long was the true living embodiment of Mary Pelle, a house that loves the wilderness and all its inhabitants. Every other founder had to be in close proximity to the chief healer, who's born like every 500 years. We can all actually call the Mary Pelle house the founding house. But the others, let's talk about the others. DJ Bohm, who is the founder of the Merikotka house, was the first prediction because he would be the receiver, the chief receiver of the chief healer's message. And he would be the one to put forth the implicate order. It was so shocking to all of us that DJ Bohm was in fact born in the founding year and month of the school, just a few days later. That's also one of the reasons why we have to keep going back to the primary conversation of 1965 and why I took you back to Swetsi to listen to the chief healer and the chief receiver conversing. Next, let's move on to the Mary Mies house. The founder of the Mary Mies house would be a man who understood oracles, who was a gifted linguist, and who had an uncanny demeanor, bravery in spades with a humble heart. Sure enough, you know who I am talking about. We had Professor Wanderson in 1922, like you said, was born in New Zealand, but he was the embodiment of the Mary Mies house, and he was loved by his students of religious studies. And finally, the Mary Metzo house. Mysterious, esoteric house, the house where we put things that are unfathomable. So this had to be a person who was so mysterious and spiritually entertaining that everyone who met him felt weird, but left gleefully believing that the game was worth the candle. When someone says the game was worth the candle or not, it's quite clear that it's Alan Watts. He embodies everything that is unfathomable and blissful. So you see, it's not necessarily who comes together to form the school or to form an institute, but it's who brings to life what the school embodies. Not becoming, but being. And I'll share a letter by Professor Wanderson that describes this being toward the end of our conversation today and after I've answered some other questions. Let's address your other two questions, shall we? One is the question about the family friend, and the second is how Ogilvy comes to the scene. All right, let's take the second one first. The Mary Pelle founder, William Long, was interested in studying the wilderness of Newfoundland and Labrador.
Oh, Canada.
When he started exploring Nova Scotia in the 1880s, he heard about Ogilvy's exploratory surveys. So he contacted Ogilvy to learn about Canada's Atlantic wilderness. Now, Ogilvy was already surveying Western Canada at the time. So what he did was he introduced Long to some of his friends from, like basically his friends, but these are families who had come from Finland and who had settled in Thunder Bay. But they were familiar with the Atlantic wilderness, including the George River Caribou in northern Labrador. And it was during these many interactions that Long heard about Professor Dahatyavine, who was about, I think, 8 or 9 years at the time. She seemed naturally gifted in astronomy to him, and he always called her a child prodigy. Long's writing inspired her to learn about herbology, and that stayed with her for years as she started excelling at potion making, and slowly she started being known as the alchemist. It was Long who introduced Ogilvy and Professor Dahatyavine, and the three of them spent months discussing Ogilvy's explorations in Western Canada. Before we go down that rabbit hole, let's circle back to Professor Dahatyavine and Copernicus. She and Professor Dumbledore started at Hogwarts at the same time. She was sorted in Ravenclaw and he in Gryffindor. Now I know, Aranya, how you feel that Luna should be in Hufflepuff, Harry in Slytherin, Ron in Gryffindor, and Hermione in Ravenclaw. So you should be glad when I tell you that at least these two best friends were in different houses. But Professor Dahatyavine was the mischievous one and Professor Dumbledore was always the decoy. These two folks in the first or the second year, I believe, that's 92 or 93, we're talking about 1892, like 100 years before Harry and their time. So 1892, 93, they started believing the stories and they started diving deeper into the stories about Copernicus's couplet and prediction. And then these two best friends decided that they should go on a mission to find the custodians and retrieve the notes in the hope that Professor Dahatyavine's brilliant brain could crack the code. You already know that all misfits, like yours truly, naturally tend to trust Professor Dumbledore, and that family was no different. Professor Dumbledore helped them see the risk they were carrying for generations without knowledge of the contents, and also let them understand that it is safer to keep the notes at Hogwarts instead. And that's how Tahati Arvine actually got the code that she could crack later. But do you know who those custodians were? Any guesses, Aranya?
I don't know. How would I guess that? Like, this is a story that is new to me. I didn't even know all of this.
Well, those custodians were the Susi Petunens from Lapland.
I did not see that coming. Yeah, actually you're right. I should have made the Hufflepuff Meribelle connection when Professor Abbott accompanied us to interpret the Chief Healer's message. Because she's a Hufflepuff and she's also the current owner of the Leaky Cauldron. That explains a lot. Professor Scamander, this is a lot to unpack, and I'm sure we did not answer the central question about Old Crow and the Thestrals, but I don't believe this was a deflection on your part, like so many times before during my thesis. But this conversation has kind of opened many tributaries, and I would need to review them before we move forward. So I'm not sure if when can we write Chapter 1, or maybe this should be Chapter 1. For now, can you show me that letter by Professor Wanderson about being and not becoming?
Oh, sure. Here you go. In fact, Aranya, read it out for me so I can see what Cassandra saw in her vision.
I'll do it right away. Human Transformation, Independent of Knowledge and Time by Alan Anderson, November 16th, 1994. So for the purpose of our fictitious project, since he's Alan W. Anderson, you will hear me talk about him as Professor Wanderson, because the wand is still there. His manuscript has, like, the draft copy is 29 pages, but I think I'm only doing 14 pages or so. Some 20 years ago, I was privileged to be invited by the world-renowned spiritual teacher, Chidu Krishnamurti, to undertake with him a series of videotaped dialogues. Their object was to bring forward the kernel of his teaching. In essence, he thought that each human being is responsible for his or her own transformation, which is not dependent on knowledge or time. In another context, he wrote in his own hand, "The core of Krishnamurti's teaching is contained in the statement he made in 1929 when he said, 'Truth is a pathless land.'" These two statements, namely that one's own transformation is independent of knowledge and time, and that truth is a pathless land, are almost intimately related. Though on first glance they seem markedly distinct, nonetheless, these statements are inseparable. On perceiving the reciprocal union of these two principal affirmations, one glimpses the undivided nature of genuine spirituality. Spirituality and wholeness are also inseparable, but the splendid word wholeness has in recent decades fallen on miserable times. It is used by many now to express the goal of growth techniques and methods by one or another party with a program to sell. The misuse of the word has provincialized the concept and turned it into a catchword that divides rather than heals. But this fine word can be rectified and restored to its proper usage if it is reunited to spirit instead of being left to the agendas of traditional and popular psychologies. This hard remark provokes the question of the meaning of each word, spirituality and wholeness. I hope the progress of this paper will begin to disclose their meaning until at the conclusion of this essay, I shall attempt a formulation that perhaps will restore the words to their home ground. Now, we might not get to the end of the conclusion of this essay because I'm not reading the full draft, which is like 29 pages, but I will share the link in the show notes. Anyways, let's move forward. The topic of this paper does not lend itself to the usual academic approach of research that leads to erudition. On the contrary, it does not move by adding one thing to another, whether by information or analysis. It moves not by addition, but by subtraction. It seeks not more, but less. It moves in the mode of meditation. This is because it labors in the field of self-inquiry. Authentic self-inquiry has received little attention throughout the long stretch of recorded human history. This is because genuine self-inquiry is independent of both outward and inward authority. The outward being the imposition of political and economic constraints, and the inward being the tyranny of ideas and the stream of consciousness that flows from them and feeds them. Outward authority is easily recognized. Inward authority is much more subtle. It is a psychological self-bondage. To make matters worse, it harbors ambivalence. It lets itself be dominated by scientific, philosophical, and religious ideas, which it receives at second and third hand, yet at the same time, it intellectually and emotionally drugs itself into a virtual substance dependency on these ideas and ideals. A principal mark of psychological self-bondage is that these ideas and ideals, while in their fancied modes of truth, goodness, and beauty, are contemplated in abstraction only. Embodying them in real life is shunned like the plague. Moral and spiritual cowardice are endemic to our species, whereas physical courage is demonstrated in one form or another every day. As for moral courage, who among us is ready to stand alone against a majority of our fellows? As for spiritual courage, who among us is ready upon the instant to die the psychological death to our very imagined self-identity, without which there can be no self-liberation? These questions cannot be answered collectively by common consent, nor by meanderings among the denizens of the so-called collective unconscious. They can be answered only by the individual, by oneself alone and unaccompanied. Genuine self-inquiry realizes this groundless ground, which is virgin, uncharted, pathless, and unimagined. One's persona disappears into this unthought and nameless emptiness, for this emptiness is reality, and reality is neither an event nor an experience. These words are unintelligible so long as the persona is mistaken for the self. Self-inquiry reveals the persona as an ephemeral phenomenon of the self. To put the matter loosely, while the me is mistaken for the I, the words in the previous paragraph will remain enigmatic and for some plain gibberish. This is why pure self-inquiry has received little attention throughout the long stretch of recorded human history. That level of human transformation, which is independent of knowledge and time, is not realized outside of self-inquiry, and for that reason, it remains a rarity. At this point in our discussion, it is necessary to point up that fatal misconception which holds that self-inquiry and introspection are one and the same. This misunderstanding arises out of a failure to discern that the inward world of motives, moods, feelings, and wishes is equally external to the ego, as is the outward world we see, hear, touch, smell, and taste. On grasping the centrality of the ego and its standpoint, one is in a position to give both the outer and inner worlds their due. It is from this base and standpoint that most of the higher products of culture in the arts and sciences spring in all their ideality and beauty. Their ideality stretches indefinitely into the past. While in the present, artistic and scientific ideality anticipate the novel future. Unfortunately, the egoic standpoint does not overcome the illusion that the ego is an independent substance and being. This invertebrate illusion generates the force of the twin concepts, personality and experience. These two concepts, personality and experience, undergird the theoretical structures of theology, philosophy, and depth psychology. These questions prepare one to begin self-inquiry. One moves intemporally from there to the intuition that even one's sense of self-presence cannot be equated with ego. Without this distance on the normal function of ego, self-inquiry cannot flower. Only intelligence is required for self-inquiry, and not any of the games of egoic intellect which impose rules of dogma, doctrine, ways and means, method and scope. Housed as these are within conventional interpretations and social structures, they are rarely studied for their power both to hide and to disclose their roots. Such roots reach down into the subsoil of primordial wisdom. Historically, those few who touched this wisdom have most often paid dearly for it. Witness in the Western tradition the execution of Jesus and Socrates. If not in league with the egoic standpoint, what is the character of that intelligence which attracts, supports, and illuminates pure self-inquiry? This question and the question of the self are inseparable, for when they are studied with the pure act of attention, these questions reveal that the ego, so far from being at the center of the self, is as external to it as the world of the five senses and the internal world of thought, feeling, and will. They are the worlds of body and soul, and the self cannot be reduced to either or both of them. It will not offend Krishnamurti's spirit if in this meditation I refer to scriptural passages from our Western tradition and from others. In our 18 videotaped conversations, I quoted a number of scriptural references from various cultures. He never once objected to this practice. Rather, he objected to the misuses of sacred texts. Unless one risks the living out of whatever is of truth in such texts, they remain a meaningless clutter of so-called knowledge, a heap coffined in the past, and in no sense an occasion for present self-awakening. Psychological knowledge is what is meant here, and not practical know-how, which is knowledge of a different order. Plato's virtual transcription of Socrates' apology remains one of the clearest invitations to self-inquiry in our Western tradition. Just before the judges render the verdict that will execute him, Socrates says, "An unexamined life is not worth living." In the text, he includes his own life in this. In saying that an unexamined life is not worth living, he necessarily invites the question, who is the examiner and the examinee? If it is my life that I am examining, where do I, the examiner, leave off and my life as object begin? Or looked from the standpoint of my life, the examined, where does my life leave off and I, the examiner, begin? Furthermore, where does my life leave off and the life of another and others begin? I am not raising these questions for the sake of mystification or as a shrewd rhetorical device by which to benumb a critical focus. On the contrary, if one sits with them quietly, they open out upon a crucial distinction between two orders of attention. One we give to physical and technical matters which require a change of position in temporal and spatial objects. The other attention we give to attitudes which we take for granted in our relatively unconscious lust for security and a settled life. It is this latter attention which properly obtains while one is examining one's life. Only such a non-utilitarian attention can reveal how it is the case that human transformation is independent of knowledge and time. Let us examine the possibility of such a transformation through contemplating the relation of knowledge to time, of understanding to timelessness, and of not misunderstanding to timing. As we look into these, the meaning of the topic of this meditation might come clearer, as well as the characters of spirituality and wholeness. The English word knowledge is etymologically somewhat obscure. However, what seems fairly certain is that it derives from Middle English, where it meant to admit, confess. The element of confession gives the word a certain religious aura, which confers upon it a high seriousness. An anterior etymology relates knowledge to note, whose main source is Latin nota, a brand, a mark by which one recognizes what is at hand. These two etymological roots lent the word knowledge a high respect and an air of permanency. Both these characteristics of the word point to the ease with which the concept knowledge has uncritically attained to its eminence. The word's relation to time is clearly on the side of the past, since what bears a mark has already been branded. The bearer of the brand is easily reduced in the mind to a tool for carrying the mark, as the mark is all important for identification, yet it remains an abstraction. As an abstraction, it has the power to last well beyond the existence of its bearers. This seemingly magical property so enhances its dignity that it is easily forgotten that the mark, as such, is of the past and to fix the mind upon it, imagining it an authentic creature of the present, is to misunderstand oneself and the mark also. These remarks do not apply to the practical order where the use of memory are absolutely necessary. One could not drive a car, wash dishes, get to work, or operate the most sophisticated instruments without the use of memory, let alone undertake prodigious reckonings in the calculative order. On the contrary, I refer here to the matter of attitude. That is, whether the measure of my present living is a mark from the past to which I am attached, or whether my attention is one of listening and looking without attachment. One of the keys to how knowledge almost certainly does govern attitude is furnished by one word, recognition. To recognize is to know again. We cannot recognize what we have not known before. This is crucial for our emotional relation to symbol, dogma, and ritual, since all three relate so intimately to our belief structures. These structures we impose upon the present by whatever means we feel necessary and appropriate to make the present continuous with the past. Any break in this dreamy chain we interpret as a threat to where and how we are in the world. Our inveterate habit of superimposing upon the present an image of the past is devastating to interpersonal relationships, since it disables us from meeting the other with a fresh and an innocent eye. Before we are aware of it, the experience of our first encounter with the other converts to a belief, and from then on, each new experience with the other is reduced in our mind to that belief. Such an attitude and conviction are lethal to understanding and leave us perennial prisoners of time cemented in the past. There is distinction between knowledge as static and knowing as dynamic, which points a way out of this bondage. Knowing is a movement. Within knowing, we can distinguish three orders. Knowing which serves the practical order, knowing which is accumulative, additive, and increases the store of static knowledge, and knowing which is non-cumulative and non-additive, which moves through each present instant, taking in the unprecedented as that is disclosed to it without beginning or end. Here the mind contemplates its object without imposing upon it any agenda whatsoever. There is a remarkable text in St. John's Gospel which, when translated strictly from Greek, discloses this untrammeled way of knowing. This is eternal life, that they should keep on knowing thee, the only true God. I am not concerned in the implicit theology of this text. It is the phrase that they should keep on knowing which arrests attention in the context of this meditation. Here the verb to know is in the present active subjunctive. The subjunctive is a mood expressing potentiality. The present tense indicates an ongoingness. The term eternal life joins two words that seem mutually exclusive. Classically, eternity has meant timeless existence, that is, existence without change. This is not the same as infinite time or endless duration. Eternity is the ever-abiding now, without respect to any then or when, any past or future. However, life as we ordinarily understand it is subject to time, for the individual or the collective life comes to be and passes away. The life of a thing has a beginning, a middle, and an end, a life cycle. Finite existence, which is existence subject to change, endures a temporal career. Then what can eternal life possibly mean for a mortal existence? Our text, if contemplated deeply, will generate this question. The unprecedented has no antecedent. It is the absolute new, as distinguished from what is novel. The great Danish thinker Kierkegaard defined the instant as an atom of eternity. This implies that it cannot be one moment among others in the temporal chain of cause and effect. The Buddha, noting the circularity of cause and effect, observed that if there is only one cause and effect, then there cannot be the liberation of self-awakening. Self-awakening is an instantaneous leap from causalism into a sphere unmodified by the use of time. We are now in a position to contemplate the seemingly contradictory term eternal life. even though the sphere into which self-awakening leaps is not contaminated by time, it nonetheless irradiates and redeems it. This being so, eternal life is realizable now upon this present instant of self-awakening. Eternal life is not limited to a beginning after death, but as eternal, it is ever present, and as life, it is now. Self-awakening is not a gradual illumination, as though one were lifting a shade within a darkened room. Self-awakening instantaneously sees the intrinsic light of one's own being, where before there was only darkness, caused by the blindness of misunderstanding. This is eternal life, that they should keep on knowing thee. Nothing of this knowing can be reduced to the known. This knowing is ever afresh, unprecedented, free from the duality of the knower and the known, experiencer and the experienced, controller and the controlled. One keeps on awakening to it that there is no intrinsic separation and division, since in the words of Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, nothing was divided and there is nothing to unite. Knowledge, which is a bondage of time, no longer hinders knowing, which keeps on leaping into the sphere of the abiding, the ever-present now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sartastic Beast and Where to Find Them. The intro and outro music is by Yaakov Goldman, courtesy of Free Music Archive.